Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in KHOI's seven-county listening area. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today, together with Joy V.
Welcome to Local Talk, and thank you for listening in.
Joy, last night you recorded a town hall forum hosted by South Central Federation of Labor about our current state of health care in the U.S. and in Iowa, which included a discussion of possible outcomes in the future. South Central Iowa Federation of Labor is a coalition of unions and the official organization of the National AFL-CIO, representing 23 counties in South Central Iowa.
There were doctors there that are dealing with real situations and problems in their practices. Things they explained were an eye-opener for me. I am looking forward to airing some of what they said here on Local Talk. We'll bring it to you on Monday, the 21st. A few weeks ago, we brought you some recordings from Revolution Iowa, From Protest to Power, a convention organized by CCI Action associated with Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. The convention included keynote speeches by Senator Bernie Sanders and Black Lives Matter founder Alicia Garza. And there were also numerous workshops about issues everyday Iowans face, including health care. Evan Berger is a senior organizer for CCI Action and was one of the organizers of the conference. He has joined us for a brief follow-up on how topics brought up at the conference have played out since. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Joy.
Did the conference inspire people to get involved?
I think so. You know, it's been a month and a half now, and we've really seen a huge uptick in people involved in our events. We've been kind of going full steam ahead, and I think people are fired up, you know, not just because of the convention, but the larger political moment that we're in right now.
Tell us some of the things that have happened as a result of the conference or afterwards.
Yeah, definitely. So we, like I said, we've been going full steam ahead, you know, so we have a couple different issue areas that we work in. I think we discussed last time. So some of the big ones are our healthcare, obviously, is really hot right now. Clean water, climate, immigration, and racial justice.
What have people been doing?
We were just talking about healthcare, Joy. So I'll start with that one. So the question of how to make our healthcare system more just in America is obviously still a hot topic. So we've really been pushing on our federal elected representatives. So just yesterday, a bunch of CCI people went up to, I believe it was Webster City, for a town hall with Joni Ernst. We're pushing her on Medicare for All. That's really our solution that we see to the healthcare system in Iowa, or in America.
And how did she respond?
Well, you know, if you've seen her in person, she she kind of poo-poos it and moves on. But I think, you know, we made our case very clearly. I think it's pretty clear that she doesn't have maybe a solution to offer in response. Another big thing that's been really hot recently is clean water. This is a long-term fight that we're in. Our analysis really is that factory farms are a big cause of Iowa's water problem. So right after the convention, we launched a petition to the DNR asking them to strengthen what's called the master matrix process, which is the permitting process that is used to approve animal confinements when people want to build them. We've organized communities across the state who have seen how broken this process is. And all those communities are coming together for this petition. It's a formal petition. It's not just like a change.org or something where you sign on, but it's a legal petition to the DNR saying this process isn't strong enough. We need to strengthen it. It's leading to Iowa's dirty water, and you're not doing your job as the DNR. So
a DNR is Department of Natural Resources.
That's right.
In Iowa, state agency.
That's right, yeah.
Why are you focusing on the DNR? Why are they the target?
They're the legal body that enforces the master matrix system, and they have the duty to protect Iowa's water and air.
And the master matrix system is how you determine if a confinement can be built?
Yeah, exactly. So, mm-hmm. You know, if someone wants to build one of these things, they fill out the master matrix form and scored by the county. I won't get too far into the details, but it's scored by the county, but then the DNR chooses whether to accept or deny the county's scoring. So there mm-hmm. are a number of different pieces, but the DNR is the one who sets the rules for the overall process. And again, I think if we look at the results, which is over 750 impaired waterways in Iowa and more every year, clearly something is not working and more manure is ending up in our water, and we need to fix that system.
The air with communities, a lot of people have these confinements close to people's homes, and
definitely
it's an issue.
I'm glad you bring that up, because the master matrix was really designed to take three concerns into account. Water, air, and community are the three sections of the master matrix. And I think, again, if you look at the situation here in Iowa, the system is failing on all counts. Our water is getting dirtier, our air is getting dirtier, and communities are being torn apart. So that's kind of our argument. So like I said, we delivered this petition to the DNR. We've also been pushing Governor Reynolds on this issue, want her to weigh in. And there was also this big ag summit that Bruce Rastetter, who's kind of a kingpin in Iowa politics, put on. We protested that and used that as an opportunity to point out the problems in Iowa's agriculture system, too. So a lot going on, that's for sure.
CCI Action is also has some initiatives to get people directly involved with electoral politics.
Yes, that's right. So a couple big things have happened even just since the convention. The first one is kind of internal, which is that we've launched a state PAC and a political action committee. And, you know, PACs definitely have a bad rap sometimes, especially super PACs, because they, you know, they allow dark money to kind of influence elections. But this is a state PAC, so it's, you know, everything has to be disclosed. And really, this is our way of working hand in hand in candidates. We're really excited about it. So we put that into work immediately. We've endorsed in a city council race down in Pleasant Hill, which seems like, you know, it's a pretty small race, but we see it as a chance to test out this model of movement politics, as we call it.
And so you're encouraging people to actually run for office.
Yeah. So we're recruiting, training, and supporting candidates. Mm-hmm. And then so now that he's declared and we've endorsed, we're able to work hand in hand with him. So just last weekend, I was out on the doors. There were about 20 CCI Action members who were out on the doors, knocking on folks' doors in Pleasant Hill and talking to them about why Ross was running, why we're supporting Ross, and encouraging them to do the same. So really, you know, yes, recruiting, training, supporting candidates. And the other piece of our movement politics work right now is we've begun a gubernatorial endorsement process. We did just release a kind of candidate scorecard. Almost all the candidates sent in questionnaires and kind of laid out where they stand on the issues. So we summarized that, and you can find that on our Facebook page we just posted yesterday.
So you used the term movement politics.
Yes.
What is movement politics?
So movement politics, is the model that we're trying to enact in Iowa, where we marry social movements with electoral politics. I think the Ross example is a perfect one. You know, Ross has been involved in all these organizing campaigns for years and years and years. And just last year, he was talking to his city council about the minimum wage increase that Polk County put into place. And, you know, it's all kind of water under the bridge now since the state passed the preemption law, taking away the ability for counties to raise the minimum wage. But Polk County did pass a minimum wage increase, and there were a number of cities that were opting out of that minimum wage increase, and Pleasant Hill was one of them. So, you know, Ross had been involved in the, you know, organizing for economic justice for a long time. In this particular situation, he saw how his city council members were not representing him. And because of his work in our organizing campaigns, he chose to run for office. And, you know, asked for our help. And like I said, we just went through the endorsement process for him and chose to endorse him. And now we're working hand in hand. So it's not just him as the candidate, but really it's the movement.
I mean, politics by its very nature is based on campaigns and movements. So
Right. Am
I hearing you correctly that what you call movement politics is setting some sort of criteria for involvement based on particular social justice or environmental issues? How would you describe it? I'm putting words in your mouth here.
In our case, that's true. I would also say that the right has been doing movement politics for a long time. And so when you look at things like the Tea Party or evangelical Christians getting involved in politics, you see the same sort of model.
It's issue-based.
Yeah, it's issue-based. And, you know, I think you can see how there are different issues that are at play, but it's the same sort of idea where first people get involved on the issues, and then as an outgrowth of that, they move into electoral politics, and they bring this whole base of people along with them.
You live in Slater and grew up in Story County.
That's right, yeah.
What made you return to Iowa after graduating from Columbia University? What makes you dedicate yourself to this social organizing in Iowa?
Well, it's a long story, I think. So the very short version is, like you said, I grew up right outside of Huxley, and then I went to Columbia University. And while I was out there, it was right when Occupy Wall Street was going on. I'd been politically aware before, but that's really what got me into the streets and showed me, like, you know, what organizing is all about. After that, I've really been organizing ever since. And when I graduated from college, I was looking around and I said, you know, there's a lot of people doing community organizing in places like New York and, you know, in big cities. But Iowa is where I'm from, and there aren't a whole lot of groups out there. There's really a need, I think, for building people power here in Iowa. So I ended up coming back and have been here ever since, happily ever after.
We are speaking with Evan Berger from CCI Action. If someone wants to get involved or learn more about CCI Action, where should they look?
Yeah, the easiest way is cciaction.org is our website. Obviously, we're on Facebook and Twitter, and our office phone number if you want to give us a ring is 515-255-0800. 515-255-0800.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Evan.
As I grow older, my heart grows stronger, and I can feel the world, and I can bear it, the weight of the suffering arises in light and lifts from my shoulders. We're all in this together. There is no us and them. We're all in this together, from here until the end. We keep trying to divide us, the young ones from the old, the men from the women, the rich ones from the poor, the good ones from the bad ones, the sick ones from the sane, this one from that one. What have we to gain? For we're all in this together. There is no us and them. We're all in this together, from here until the end.
Susan Osborne with Divide and Conquer. Susan Osborne was a member of the Ames community who now lives in Washington State and has a distinguished career in singing. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm Ursula Rudenberg. As Charlottesville remains front and center in the national awareness here at KHOI, we wanted to be able to connect on a personal and community level with people in Charlottesville. One of the nice things about being a community radio station is that we have articulate friends in many places. So we called Nathan Moore, our community radio colleague in Charlottesville, Virginia. He's the station manager of WTJU Community Radio at the University of Virginia. Nathan Moore is somebody that we know personally, and so we know that he made a point of moving to Charlottesville, for which he has a very special personal affection, to raise his young family. In the interview that he gave us, he identifies himself as being part of a citizen action group that ended up in the middle of the street violence, as well as being station manager at WTJU.
My name is Nathan Moore. I am on the steering committee of a group called Together Seaville. It's a local political organization here in Charlottesville that works to ensure that everyone in our community is safe, secure, heard, and has access to needed resources to lead flourishing and meaningful lives. Particularly in the Trump era, we try to build a bulwark locally and in Virginia against the river of filth and destruction coming down from Washington. A few years ago, I used to work for Pacifica Radio as the National Programming Coordinator based out of the national office.
We're speaking on Monday, the 14th. Can you tell us, Nathan, right now what's going on in Charlottesville?
Right now, Charlottesville is trying to heal, trying to recoup, trying to process our feelings. A lot of heavy emotions in town, a lot of trauma that a lot of people are dealing with who were there on the scene when a domestic terrorist crashed his car into a crowd of anti-racist demonstrators, killing one woman named Heather Heyer and badly injuring another 19 that had to go to the hospital. A number of others also injured, but not at hospital level. You know, my wife was right on the scene there. She first responder treated two of the crash victims, two of the incident victims, and it's heavy. It's heavy. A number of my friends were right there in that crowd or near that crowd, and they had to leave for the day and go just deal with it. I mean, seeing bodies fly through the air and crash and sort of broken and bloodied bodies on the ground like that is an intense experience. It was a war zone. And so, you know, 2 days after a war zone, you clean up and you try and heal collectively, but there's a lot of feelings still happening.
Shocking all over the world. Was your wife at ground zero right as these events were unfolding?
Neither Lisa nor I were right at the crash incident where the car actually hit the crowd. We were about four blocks away. My own role in this and my group, Together Seaville, our role in this was we actually pulled permits for two other city parks that were both quite close to Emancipation Park right there where the alt-right and all the others were coming together. So we pulled permits for Justice Park, which was two blocks east of Emancipation Park, and also for a park called McGuffey Park, which was one block west of Emancipation Park. And we used both really as staging areas for anti-fascists who were starting their day or who needed a break, who needed a snack and water, who needed a medic tent. And so my role was to run the sound system for music and speeches and help coordinate all the other pieces like food and water and medic tents. My wife was at the medic tent, and we both got texts and alerts that something very, very bad had happened on 4th Street. And so we found out quickly what it was. Lisa ran down there, got there about 5 minutes after the car incident had occurred, and she treated a couple of women on the ground.
Is the National Guard still in Charlottesville?
I don't know if they're still in Charlottesville or not. I know the Virginia State Troopers and, of course, local county, city, and university police are still on alert. But I think they're starting to mosey on as well. It seems the imminent threat. Fortunately, the roving bands of fascists and Nazis seem to have mostly exited Charlottesville. You know, whatever jobs these goons had, they seem to have mostly gone back to at this point. Yesterday, on Sunday at 2 p.m., Jason Kessler, our homegrown fascist, who invited Richard Spencer and the other groups to Unite the Right in Charlottesville, he was going to do a press conference at 2 with Richard Spencer. Spencer was a no-show, and Kessler began his press conference at 2 and said a few sentences and then was quickly drowned out by those who were there to oppose and stand up and say, no, you don't have a home here anymore. You're not welcome in this town anymore. And ran him off. For the most part nonviolently, although he, a woman did tackle him in a flower bed. So, there's that. But, you know, this town really did come out in force to show the white nationalists, white supremacists, and fascists that they are not welcome here, that their message is certainly not welcome here. But still, trying to heal from that kind of trauma is going to take some time.
Nathan, can you describe the background of how this all came about over a statue, and can you trace the history of this statue and when it was erected?
The reason why these guys showed up in the first place ostensibly was because the City Council of Charlottesville voted to remove the statue of Robert E. Lee, a Confederate general, leader of the Confederate Army during the Civil War. It was in a park called Lee Park. That park had been renamed as part of the same package of proposals. It was renamed to Emancipation Park, and the vote was to move the statue of Robert E. Lee to some other location, to sell it to a collector or whatever, someplace where it could be used for historical interpretation if that's what somebody wanted to do. But the idea was that it does not need to be right in the center of Charlottesville's main park that shows off who we are, that this public space is a reflection of what we are as a city and what we care about as a city. You know, cities have to make decisions about what their public spaces are going to constitute, what they're going to look like, what's going to be enabled, and what kind of community is going to be built and reflected based on those public spaces. And Charlottesville decided that it did not need to any longer put the Confederacy literally on a pedestal. So that was the vote. The statue originally was erected in the 1920s at the height of out-in-the-open racism in America, at the height of KKK membership in America. That statue was erected very much as a message to the local black population to know their place. When you look at photos of the dedication of that statue, as well as one four blocks away to Stonewall Jackson, at both dedications, the Klan was out, and you could see the Klan in all their regalia at the dedications of these statues in the 1920s. It was not as if it was right after the Civil War and it was a remembrance of those who had just passed away or something. It was 60 years later as part of this Southern Lost Cause narrative, which is just a terrible ideology, the idea that really the Confederacy should have won and really didn't. It's still a great noble cause. It just didn't quite work out, and it's utter crap. But It is part of the narrative of white supremacy and white nationalism that still gets played out in certain sectors. So a number of cities have voted to remove these statues, not just Charlottesville, also New Orleans, also St. Louis, also some other places. These sold statues to the Confederacy, and in many of those cities, they have a similar history. In the 19-teens, 1920s, or even later in some cases, they were put in place to really be a reminder of white supremacy, an institutional reminder of white supremacy. And a lot of these cities now are revisiting the point.
Are the plans to remove the statue still in place?
Legally, through a really weird quirk, Charlottesville does not have full control over its own decisions as to what to do with Confederate statues. Virginia, the state of Virginia, has a statute about statues to the Confederacy that it requires some kind of approval from the state itself to be able to remove it. However, Charlottesville is saying that this statue predates that statute, and so it's actually in the courts right now as to whether it'll be able to be removed or not. We'll find out about that sometime, I presume, later this year, but I don't think a date has been set for that decision from a judge.
Did the people of Charlottesville feel that the president and his administration were in any way responsible for this to happen? I mean, I know the ACLU came out to support the right for this group to demonstrate.
I don't know about all of Charlottesville. I can tell you that I and many people who run with me very much see the fascist who killed people or who killed a woman on the streets of Charlottesville and Donald Trump as being on the same spectrum. And that spectrum is narrow. It's not that Donald Trump literally murders anybody, but, you know, I very much appreciate what the ACLU does. I think it's important that they're there. I think they really made a bad call on this one. They have limited resources like the rest of us, and for whatever reason, they chose to use some of their limited resources to defend this. I think it was a really poor choice on their part. Why the white nationalists and neo-Confederates and fascists and neo-Nazis chose Charlottesville is an interesting question. I think there are several factors that all kind of come together for it. One is that we do have a homegrown fascist organizer here, a guy who has pretty serious problems of his own, but he is connected to a lot of these different folks, and he kind of made a splash for himself when he was trolling through the old tweets of an African-American city councilor we've got and found some pretty objectionable tweets that the city councilor did some years ago. Anyway, that kind of put him on the map, the white nationalist map, so to speak. And so he was able to parlay that influence to bring Richard Spencer and Augustus Invictus and some of these other far-right fascists to town. Again, why they chose Charlottesville, though, I think partly because of the connection. Also, you know, Richard Spencer, the leader of one of the most famous white nationalist groups right now, he has a Charlottesville connection. He went to the University of Virginia and graduated from there. And he lives not too far away up in Northern Virginia, just outside D.C. So it was sort of convenient for him. I also think, though, that maybe another reason is that we are a small city. The city of Charlottesville is only 45,000 people. You add the suburbs and it's, you know, over 100,000, but, you know, the whole metro area is not large. And so if you fill up a small city park with several hundred white nationalists, it looks big. It looks like you're having a really big impact when you're in a small city like this. And so I think that's a big part of it. And then also being a college town that voted more than 80% for the Democratic presidential candidate, it looked like an opportunity to them to stick it to the liberals. And so that's what they attempted to do over the weekend. And the way they, of course, stuck it to the liberals in this case was through domestic terrorism, through committing an act of terrorism against a populace that was out there peacefully demonstrating, and one of the fascists drove his car into that crowd.
And Nathan, usually when there's a calamity like this, there's public healing rituals or ceremonies that people do on a community level to bring people together. Is there anything like that happening in Charlottesville?
Absolutely, absolutely. Last night, my own group, Together Seville, hosted a potluck. About 150 people came out, and we had sort of an open mic, shared stories about our experiences from the day with takeaways and just a chance to be with people in a moment where we needed to be with our people. Immediately following that, actually, there was a much larger gathering. It was a vigil at the site of the terrorist incident where the woman was killed on 4th Street, 4th and Water Streets. And that vigil, you know, filled up a whole block full of people, and a number of clergy spoke. The woman's family came and also said a few words, and it was a very moving moment on the street last night. Tonight, there's a large community conversation happening at what's called the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. It's a former segregated school that has now been turned into a community center. That community conversation takes place tonight, Monday evening. And then there's additional events happening throughout the week. You know, a lot of trauma right now, though, for sure, and a lot of people who are having to get things out. You know, even having not been at the site of the crash, just seeing people who were in pain, seeing people who had been hit, you know, and that was just one of many incidents of violence that the fascists rained down upon the people of Charlottesville and anti-racists. There were clergy lined up along the streets, you know, counter-protesting their event. And the fascists were pepper-spraying as they walked by, you know, just spraying clergy members in the eyes as they walked by. And, you know, the street medics were there helping. All of us were there helping. But really, it was just, you know, a lot of things to process right now in this town.
When you close your eyes and think back on the whole thing, what is the image that sticks in your mind? What do you take away from it personally?
As far as my experience of the day, the thing that I am struck by is, I guess, how we read about wars, we see sometimes footage of war zones and cities, and it didn't occur to me what that must feel like for people who actually live there, that it's just their city, it's just their streets that they're used to, you know, walking their dog on or going to the ice cream shop or whatever it might be. And then in a different day, in a different time, it's transformed into something entirely ugly, something entirely wretched and foreign and deadly. That's what I see is seeing fascists dressed up in their, it would be comical cosplay type stuff, except for the fact that they hurt people and kill people. And seeing them march around with their anger and their hatred is something that's seared into my memory for sure. But also seeing the people of Charlottesville and our supporters who came here in solidarity, and seeing images online later on of people all around the country, hundreds of vigils around the country for Charlottesville, standing up in solidarity and standing up and saying, no, that's not acceptable. This is not who we are as a city. It's not who we are as a people here in America. It's not the promise of America. It's not the values of fairness and equity and society rooted in empathy that we care about as a people. And it's not the values that are what has actually made America powerful and a great place. The great things about America have come when we are accepting and inclusive of all people, when we build upon the strengths of those from many backgrounds to make our country a unique and just place, when we can fight together for wins for the people, not just for the top and not just for the white folks. But then the last thing, I guess, that I want to think about is that I went back to a Dr. King sermon recently in anticipation of this event, but it sort of carried me through the weekend quite a lot as well. And that's that, you know, we know, and we really now know, that there are forces in this country who would seek to destroy lives. And we must meet and challenge those forces with courage, with a deep well of courage.
To work for justice and equity, that's the side I want to be on.
All right. Thanks, Nathan.
Thanks, Nathan. Appreciate it.
Nathan Moore, thanks for joining us. And our heart and prayers go out for your community. And I'm sorry that your community had to go through that. There's lessons to be learned. Thank you for recounting this.
Thanks for your time.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
All right.
All right.
Thank you all.
Welcome back to Local Talk. Thanks for listening. I'm Joy B., one of your hosts, today here with Ursula Rudenberg. If you just joined us, we were hearing from Nathan Moore, resident and community radio person in Charlottesville, sharing thoughts and emotions from the perspective of a local resident in the middle of things.
I mentioned earlier that Nathan Moore is the manager of WTJU Community Radio at the University of Virginia. He's actually using his radio station locally to bring comfort and has asked other community radio stations if they would deliver messages from folks in other communities. So if you feel you have a message for the people in Charlottesville, please stop by KHOI Studio at 410 Douglas today or tomorrow, or give us a call at 515-292-2878, 515-292-2878, so we can record your message. We're looking for just a few sentences from the heart. Again, that's 515-292-2878 if you'd like to send a message to the folks in Charlottesville, or better yet, come by the station. Demonstration in public spaces has become a stark issue this past week. Nathan described the shock of experiencing public spaces in Charlottesville as a war zone. This is a really specific and unique experience I recognize from being in New York City on 9/11. It is really a sudden and strange transition for residents to experience. In his interview, Nathan referred to the ACLU's decision to defend the demonstration that set off this weekend of violence. Virginia Governor McAuliffe also criticized the ACLU, saying the city of Charlottesville asked for that to be moved out of downtown Charlottesville to a park about a mile and a half away with a lot of open fields. That was the place where it should have been. We were unfortunately sued by the ACLU. The judge ruled against us. That rally should not have been in the middle of downtown. The ACLU of Virginia's executive director, Claire Gastanaga, responded by saying, and this is an abbreviated quote, "The ACLU of Virginia does not support violence. We do not support Nazis. We support the Constitution and the laws of the United States." But let's be clear, our lawsuit challenging the city to act constitutionally did not cause violence, nor did it in any way address the question whether demonstrators could carry sticks or other weapons at the event. We asked the city to adhere to the U.S. Constitution and ensure people's safety at the protest. It failed to do so. In our system, the city makes the rules and the courts enforce them. Our role is to ensure that the system works the same for everybody. In fact, this issue of the right to demonstrate on public spaces and the role that the city plays in managing that and making it safe is an ongoing topic, even here in Iowa. Veronica Fowler, the ACLU of Iowa's communications director, stopped by KHOI last night to describe situations that are currently occurring in Iowa regarding use of public space for demonstration.
There's a lot of free speech issues going on.
Explain what's going on with constitutional rights to demonstrate in Marion.
There is a gentleman named Rick Stewart who, back in September, was standing in a pedestrian area with two of his friends holding a political sign.
What do you mean by political sign?
He was holding a political candidate sign.
Okay.
Classic free speech, classic freedom to demonstrate, freedom of assembly. And a police officer stops him and says, "You can't do that." He said, "Well, do I need to go to a less busy part, you know, the street? Do I need to go over to the side?" He's like, no, you can't be doing that unless you have 72 hours prior notice and you have a permit." And so Rick Stewart knew that it was his constitutional right to do that. It doesn't get much more fundamental than that.
So in other words, in a public space, you're allowed to stand up and express yourself.
Absolutely.
As long as it's public space.
Right, right. And with other, you know, some other caveats, you know, mm-hmm. that it's a peaceful assembly and so forth. And you're not a danger and not blocking traffic and some other things. So he contacted the ACLU and we took up his case because we found out that there indeed is an ordinance in Marion that says you can't have public demonstrations without 72 hours prior notice and without a permit. So we contacted the city. We wrote a demand letter saying this ordinance must be changed. It is clearly constitutional. And the city, their first step was to say we will stop enforcing this ordinance, which we were glad about. And then we worked with them to revise the ordinance so that it doesn't unduly impinge on free speech. We're very pleased about that. And that was what was to be presented late this afternoon to the Marion City Council.
Why do you say you feel good about it?
The ordinance would not have a requirement that for a simple demonstration like that, you would have to have 72 hours prior notice and that you do not have to have a permit just for a simple public demonstration.
Why is there an ordinance needed at all if it's a constitutional right?
Cities reasonably have some ordinances. For example, if it's going to be a very, very large crowd, you might need to get a permit just to take up that much space. And if you don't, you know, if you want to go out on the streets, you might need to stay on the sidewalk. Any of us who went to the Women's March, for example, people couldn't be in the street where it was blocking traffic because law enforcement couldn't adequately block off those streets. Mm-hmm. So the walk had to stay on the sidewalk.
So even though the right to demonstrate is a constitutional entitlement,
mm-hmm.
cities typically will create some sort of parameters around mm-hmm. what is safe and acceptable within
right.
those limits.
Right. And there might be noise requirements as well if you want to use a bullhorn or something like that.
And is this something that happens a lot, that the ACLU will go to a city and say you're being too restrictive?
Unfortunately, far more often than you might think.
In Iowa?
It happens a a lot everywhere because the First Amendment is messy, right? People say and do things you might not agree with. We recently, very recently, in fact, just had a case in Windsor Heights, which is a Des Moines suburb. There's been a lot of contention about sidewalks there. Windsor Heights didn't have sidewalks. And then some residents asked for sidewalks. And sidewalks are currently being installed for the first time. And a lot of people oppose those sidewalks. The ACLU, as you can imagine, takes no position on the sidewalks. But what is disturbing is one resident had a sign in his yard protesting the sidewalks, and it said City Hall running amok. He was sent a letter that said this sign is a nuisance, something that endangers health and safety or is highly offensive. And of course, it wasn't offensive unless you disagreed with him, I suppose. And the letter said that he had to remove it within 24 hours or he would be fined up to $1,000 a day if he didn't comply. So he took it down. And down the street, another family had a big professional vinyl banner made that said basically 96% of the people oppose a sidewalk ordinance, you know, in green space over concrete. They secured it to the porch with string. Then they went on vacation. The city took down the banner itself. It didn't ask the homeowners. It didn't contact the homeowners. It knew that they were away because they'd contact the police because they wanted to make sure the police knew they were gone on vacation in case they saw suspicious activity. And they were emailed a notice saying that the banner didn't comply with safety regulations. And some weird parts of the ordinance say that it's okay, though, if you have a banner, if it has a religious message, which, of course, is blatant. Unconstitutional. You can't have ordinances that specify what you can and can't say. So that this is all happening within a matter of days and weeks.
I mean, obviously, we've all witnessed public protests taken a turn for the worst in Charlottesville. Why does the ACLU feel that it's important to be able to demonstrate politically on public property?
Yeah.
Why is this an important constitutional right?
Simply, you know, free speech, we do a lot of work, racial justice, LGBTQ rights, due process, criminal justice, immigrants' rights, voting rights. And free speech is at the core of what we do. Free speech is the foundation of our democracy. It's the foundation upon which all other rights are built, and we have to protect it even when it's hateful. Not the actions at all. Free speech does not, we don't defend violence in any way, shape, or form.
If you just joined us, this is Local Talk on KHOI, and that was Veronica Fowler, the ACLU of Iowa's Communications Director. In our last segment of today's show, we have a visitor to Iowa.
Marcin Hodkiss is a documentary photographer from London, England, who is cycling the route of the Dakota Access Pipeline, or DAPL. He says he is doing this in hopes of meeting people and seeing the landscape that surrounds the pipeline to understand whether DAPL has affected people's lives either directly, indirectly, positively, or negatively. So far, he cycled through North Dakota and South Dakota, starting in Bismarck, following the pipeline as closely as possible. He calls this project Our Land and Soil. Martin, welcome to Ames and welcome to Local Talk.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
What exactly are you doing? Tell us in your own words.
Well, I think you summed it up pretty well there. Essentially, I'm here as a cycle tourist to see parts of Midwest America that do not rank highly on the sort of tourist radar back in England.
But DAPL is a Midwest story.
It certainly is, yeah. So I chose the route because I knew that it would take me across some very unique countryside. It would take me through some towns that I wouldn't see otherwise, and it would give me a really sort of direct and close relationship with the land. Back home, I do work as a documentary photographer, but this trip is more of a personal journey. The subject matter that I usually work with is closely related to global climate change. So the fact that this bike tour has the pipeline at its core means that it's more than just a bike tour. It's something that I'm deeply interested in. I see as a sort of a global issue.
Well, one of the advantages of traveling by bicycle is you get a micro experience. You're very intimately connected to where you're going. What are you focusing on as you do this?
Yeah, you do. You're much closer to the land. You're traveling at a much slower pace than in a car. And, you know, I've had days where I've cycled 120 miles in one day, and I've run out of music on my iPhone, and I've just been left with my own thoughts and my own observations. But the things that you become closer to and the things that you notice more are the nature and the wildlife and the sounds and the small things that most people may take for granted. Sadly, on a bike, you also notice the bumps in the road as well. those are the sort of things that I'm noticing more of, which is a blessing, I think.
Now, do you find yourself observing people or the environment more?
It's split. Some days I've managed to interact and talk with quite a lot of people. When you cycle through a town that doesn't get many visitors,
people notice you.
Yeah, people notice you and they want to talk to you. Hmm. It breaks down barriers immediately. I haven't found myself needing really to approach people. People have come to me.
And what's their excuse? How do people approach you?
It just very, very directly. Why are you here? Where are you cycling to? And then the English accent comes out, you're very far from home, and that sort of conversation happens. So ironically, I find myself stopping at gas stations quite a lot. For
drinks,
water and drinks and things. And it's a place where a lot of people pass through.
So what are you seeing people-wise? So, share a few experiences
that have
stuck in your mind.
A variety of experiences, some relating very closely to the pipeline itself. In North Dakota, I met some people who tell me about their sort of daily livelihood and what it's like to work in the oil fields and the sacrifices they have to make, things that I didn't know about before coming here.
What kind of sacrifice?
Spending up to 2 months away from their family. I met a guy who lives in Arkansas, and he spends 6 weeks away from his family and then gets 6 days off to travel home. And he says that most of those 6 days can be taken up with travel, and he sometimes may only get 3 days with his family. The sacrifice is also on a daily basis. He's working up to 16-hour days, starting at 4 a.m. and not getting home until 8, 9, 10 p.m., So it's challenging, it's rigorous work for a lot of people, but without the oil pipeline and without the oil industry in North Dakota, they wouldn't have an income where they're from originally. So that's what it means to some people in North Dakota. And then completely unrelated to the pipeline, I've met on my very first day here through the cycling community, which is a very close-knit community worldwide. I met a wonderful couple, and I don't think they mind me saying their names, Tom and Janice in North Dakota, on my very first day in a bike shop. And 6 days later, I find myself knocking on their door and staying with them for the night, and then showing me all around their home and how proud they are of their land and their horses. And it's a wonderful insight and a thing that you wouldn't normally get if you were to just keep yourself to yourself and travel in a car and stay in a motel. It's certainly a unique experience.
Do you find that as you travel that people want to talk about the pipeline, or they want to ignore it?
It's certainly conversation that's instigated by me. It's not the first thing on most people's minds. Mm-hmm. When they say, what route are you taking? And quite often I've had, why have you chosen North Dakota and South Dakota? It's so boring here. And I say, well, I'm wanting to see the landscape and the land that the oil pipeline passes through, the infrastructure behind that. And then it becomes more interesting, and then they open up, and sometimes it's very positive, and they understand that the construction of the pipeline may have created jobs. I mean, I can't say personally whether it did bring local jobs to local people. That's not what I'm here to do. Some people see it as a good thing. Some people see it as a necessity. Some people don't understand why we are, as a global economy, still investing in oil and fossil fuels. So it opens up conversation that I think some people think that they can't talk to other people about. And actually last night I had a group of 15 local residents from Ames, and we all sat round and I bought some root beer and some Oreo cookies and I've got a sweet tooth, I don't know if you can tell. And we all sat round and I introduced myself and I said, I'm here to understand your opinion on oil, because as far as I see it, the fact that I'm an English person coming to America to cycle an American pipeline is irrelevant, because oil is a global issue and every country on the planet relies on it in some way, shape or form, whether it's a byproduct, plastics or pesticides. And the oil from the pipeline, most of it goes overseas, I imagine. My nationality on the subject matter is irrelevant. And so we had a very open discussion. people had questions about it, and people had questions about environmental issues, and people had things to say about their childhood and things they were used to. And it was a very interesting atmosphere to create and a very welcoming atmosphere. And I think people left with a bit more knowledge, not from me, certainly,
from each other.
They had an understanding of, you know, other people's beliefs. And I think that's at the core of this the journey for me, is connection and that discussion between people. There's lots of individual stories along the pipeline and how it's affected various farmers and how it's affected people in Standing Rock and how it brings an income to people in North Dakota. But it's essentially connecting everybody.
Now, when you travel, you also observe the land closely because you're cycling on it. What stands out in your mind about the environment? What's kind of jumped out that you may not have anticipated?
One thing that springs to mind is, maybe it's not relevant, but I see a lot of roadkill, which makes me realize how vulnerable I am as a cyclist. But the beauty of the land and that connection that we can take for granted. I think
you find the land beautiful.
I do. I grew up in East Anglia in England, and you know, a lot of people have said to me, you know, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, it's very flat, it's very boring. And actually, there's nothing I think I enjoy more than cycling along a country road surrounded by crops and surrounded by that old-fashioned industry. Whether, you know, this machinery now working at does it at a faster rate than 100 years ago, there's still an essence of history. There's still a connection to the land. And they're the things that I notice. It's the small things that you can easily take for granted that I notice more.
Is this trip turning out different than what you expected, or is it pretty much what you pictured?
Well, definitely different than I expected due to the amount of people that I'm able to meet and the amount of people who are willing to talk to me.
You didn't expect people to be as open with you. You must have a friendly face.
Maybe. I don't know. I didn't know what to expect. I thought I would get some resistance. You know, essentially, I'm here as a tourist. I've not been paid to come here. I'm not earning any money from this project. It's a personal journey for me to understand better the infrastructure and the industry of oil and how it gets from A to B and how it affects people's lives. And for me, there is no better education in the world than travel and being in a place and hearing people talk and meeting people to understand how, you know, how the world ticks. So it's eye-opening and certainly a journey of discovery for me. And I'll have lots of memories and hopefully new friends.
Presumably you're taking photographs too, since you're a professional photographer.
Yeah, I am taking photographs, but I have no, you know, like I said, I have no plans yet. I'm a student still. I'm doing a master's degree in documentary photography.
So this is really a personal journey for you.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, very much so. And I have no plans to sell photographs or anything like that. It's really very much about research and an understanding. You know, perhaps in the future I can return and make a bigger project out of it, having laid the groundwork initially this summer.
And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Martin Hodgkiss, who is a resident of London, England, who's cycling the route of the Dakota Access Pipeline, citizen of the earth. Logistics, how do you actually keep yourself safe and fed and where do you sleep?
A lot of planning went into the project beforehand. I'm not a rich man. I couldn't afford to stay in motels every night and so planning the route on a day-to-day basis and sticking to that as closely as possible was something I did before I came out here. So I wake up in the morning and I know exactly where I'm going to head and where I'm going to be, hopefully, at the end of the day.
And your plans have turned out to be realistic?
Yes. And in fact, I got about 2 days ahead of myself. And maybe I got stronger as I cycled and fitter. Yeah. And I've been staying in campsites, relatively cheap campsites, but beautiful locations. And again, seeing parts of the countryside that not many people see. A lot of the time, I'm the only person. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Carrying my own food. I have a small camping gas stove, which, if you know British people, we love a cup of tea. And the other morning I woke up to rain and I was cold. And I thought the one thing I'm going to have to start my day that'll put me in a good mood is a cup of tea. And my gas burner ran out of gas halfway through the water.
And
warm and it was heartbreaking.
So what's turned out to be the hardest thing about this trip? Other than the, you know, not having tea in the morning? I'm sorry.
That's it. That's the hardest thing. The hardest thing about this trip, I think, is battling with the elements, I think, has been challenging. You know, really diverse weather systems here in the middle of
America.
We
have some weather coming our way today.
I've been caught up in quite a horrendous storm about 5 days in as I was coming from near Watford City down to Kildare and then across sort of west back to sort of Bismarck. And 20 miles in, there was thunder, lightning, and quite possibly the hardest rain and hailstones I've ever experienced. And I ended up in a Shell garage, freezing, drinking a huge cup of coffee, trying to get warm. And a local trucker saw me and said, you know, where are you heading? And, you know, I'm heading in the same direction in about an hour. If you hang on here, I'll give you a lift. So he saved me, really. I got a lift about 30 miles along the route.
So he put your bicycle in his truck?
I put my bike in his truck, and I got in. He was a wonderful man. His name was Eric, and he was a, you know, big, hardworking, burly man. And I got in his truck, and the first thing that I was sort of presented with was a tiny, weeny little hairy chihuahua that jumped on my lap, and it was quite sort of polar opposite sort of dog that you would expect this guy to have. And he was a real sweetheart and a really nice guy. And yeah, exactly. You know, battling with the elements is definitely one thing it can slow me down and certainly dampen my morals.
Mm-hmm. Did you find the drivers pretty respectful?
Yes. Yeah, actually.
You don't have to dodge any crazy drivers?
No, I haven't at all, actually. There's some quite narrow roads, but I'm fairly visible. I'm fairly good with my cycle safety. London is a cycling town, and there's a big community of cyclists. So and our roads are smaller in England. So I'm used to cycling on a lot smaller, much narrower roads. And people here give me more than enough space when they pass. You know, they almost go off the road and into the field and back on the road again in some cases.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is awesome.
We're speaking with Martin Hodgkiss, a documentary photographer from London, England, who's cycling the route of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Martin, I'm going to give you the last word. What does this trip mean to you? And is there a website where people can kind of see what you're doing?
Yeah, my fascination and my passion is this planet we live on, how we treat it, how we treat the land, and how we leave it for future generations to come. So the subject matter, I think, it lies very close to my heart. This project means that I've experienced what we are doing to the land and what we are producing on a global scale and the effects that it's having on a variety of people. And it means that I go home much more knowledgeable and I take away a free education. And so that's what it means to me. And yeah, a shameful plug, my website is martinhodgkiss.com, and you know, you can see some of my previous projects on there and read about me and contact me and send me an email if you like.
Okay, it's martinhodgkiss.com.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Yeah.
Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember that you can also hear it online at khoifm.org and find the link to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Our theme song is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and The Morning Masterpiece at 9 a.m. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is grateful to sponsors in the business community who are making our birthday celebration possible. Today's birthday sponsor of the day is Gina McAndrews, a Century 21 real estate agent in Central Iowa, assisting home sellers and home buyers Gina McAndrews at www.century21.com or 515-635-5760. Again, 515-635-5760.
August 27th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., KHOI will have a booth at the second annual Worldly Goods Reuse, Repurpose, Recycle Market, located at the 200 block of Main Street. If you have something pretty, something useful, something desirable, something you don't need, won't you bring it to KHOI so we can turn it into cash? Please drop off your precious object for us to sell. Bring it to KHOI at 410 Douglas in Ames by August 20th so we can include it in the sale. Remember that your generous donation will help us raise money for operating expenses and keep community radio alive. Thank you. Visit worldlygoods.org for more information.